How to Help Prevent Suicide, a conversation with someone who knows. Retired California Highway Patrolman Kevin Briggs was known as the guardian of the Golden Gate Bridge. During his career, he convinced hundreds of people not to jump, not to take their own lives. Now he's sharing his story with others around the nation in hopes that the rest of us can better help people who might be suicidal. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with Kevin Briggs, as well as the executive director of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill in Maine, about preventing suicide. The numbers remain alarming, with someone dying by suicide in Maine once every 35 hours. What do you want to know about helping someone in your life choose life over suicide? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. On average, one person in Maine dies by suicide every 35 hours. Here and across the United States, suicide is the second leading cause of death among those between the ages of 15 and 24. Almost 20% of suicides in Maine are committed by veterans. Today, we're going to learn more about how we can all help change those numbers. In the studio with me, Jenna Menhert. She is the executive director of the Maine chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Also with us is Kevin Briggs. He's a California Highway Patrolman, a retired California Highway Patrolman, who is known as the guardian of the Golden Gate Bridge. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about helping someone in crisis and who may be thinking of suicide? Give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both for being here today on Maine Calling. And Kevin, I'd like to start by hearing your story. How did you come to be the guardian of the Golden Gate Bridge?
Well, first of all, thank you for having us here. And I want to point out first that there are many guardians of many Golden Gates. There's people who do the same exact work. If I was chosen to be a spokesman for that, fantastic. I'll do my best. But I did a lot of work over my 23 years with the Highway Patrol on the Golden Gate Bridge, talking to folks who were contemplating suicide. And many of those folks were over the rail, standing on an I-beam that we call the cord. And I wanted to do good at this. I wanted this to be my forte for police work. So I did a lot of research and talked with a lot of folks. And people like NAMI organization and such would tell me things. And this is how we talked to those. And I was able to go to some classes and finally even able to go to the FBI Crisis Negotiation School, which was wonderful. So this is what I really wanted to do. When you look in the eyes of someone over that rail, you can see the desperation in their eyes. Most of them want to live. They're having a really tough time. The coping mechanisms that they've had in the past no longer work, and they find themselves up over that rail.
You've convinced hundreds of people. Is there a number? Do you know? I know that you don't keep count. Has someone else kept count for you?
They came up with a number, but I've never had it. I know for years prior to 9/11, when I worked on that bridge, I handled 4 to 6 cases a month for years. And after 9/11, we put a bunch more officers down on that bridge. So it was a little less than... I hate to say a number, but people have said a lot of different numbers.
So hundreds of people. And I'm wondering if there's a common thread among the people you helped. I mean, I know you've helped men and women, different racial backgrounds, different socioeconomic backgrounds. But what is there a thread? Is there something these people have in common?
There is. Most suffer from depression, years of depression. Almost every single person who was prescribed medication for mental illness has stopped taking it for at least a month, and most feel as if they're a burden to their families.
You're a public speaker now. What do you hope that people will understand and do differently than we do now?
Right. I hope that we can get folks to start talking about this. It's not a dinner table conversation with the whole family around, but if we can spark folks to take a look around, see the signs that people are in crisis, and have that courageous conversation. I think we need to get the folks long before they get up to that bridge, because when it's up there, it's very, very difficult to get them back. But if we can have this conversation, if we can start talking about this in schools, because it happens. It happened to teenagers. If we can get that stigma reduced and start just bringing up the conversation, checking out, watching one another, man, we could really reduce this. We're losing over 41,000 folks a year just in the U.S.
Shannon Mennard, the statistics are so shocking. As we said at the beginning of the program, one person dying by suicide every 35 hours in Maine, the second leading cause of death for young people. Why is this problem so persistent? And before you answer, I want to correct something that was in an early version of the promo for the show. We said in that promo, it's the second leading cause of death for all Mainers, and that's incorrect. Second leading cause of death for young people, but it's still terrible. And the question remains, why?
Well, I think one of the really huge challenges that we have is that stigma really limits people's their willingness to reach out and get help. On average, someone waits 10 years from the time they have a mental health concern till they access help, if they ever access help. So why are people dying by suicide? Because nobody's having those courageous conversations with them. They're viewing their challenge as a weakness. They're hopeless. No one's reaching out to them. We really need to look at what each one of us can do to help prevent suicide, because suicide is preventable.
That's interesting you say suicide is preventable, because I've known in, you know, your organization and so many organizations have worked so hard at public outreach, at education. You've probably said what you just said to me about all of us talking about this 1,000 times, yet the numbers don't change. What do you think is going on?
Stigma's still here. I mean, the reality is that we discriminate based on mental health all of the time. If you watch TV, watch CNN the other day, crazy was said, I can't even, 10 times within an hour. I mean, the reality is that we say disparaging things about people's mental health all of the time, and we jump to untrue conclusions about mental health and violence, about mental health and somehow being a weakness. We put so many barriers between people talking about their mental health and actually seeking help that we need to change that culture. We need to make it so that if you walked in and you were bleeding, Jennifer, I would say, hey, let's get you some help. If I knew you well and knew that you were struggling with something, I'm not sure lots of us wouldn't have that courageous conversation, wouldn't say, hey, I'm concerned about you. And what we need to do is empower each and every one of us with the ability to start those conversations and to know how to connect someone to whatever is the right resource for them.
So I want to ask two questions about what the rest of us can do. The question for that 10 years prior to somebody attempting suicide. In that time, if you're a spouse, a loved one, even a good friend of someone, and you're concerned about them, how do you broach the subject? What is your advice about having that conversation?
Well, I think Kevin and I would probably both say a similar thing. Kevin, I would say you just have the conversation. I'm concerned about you. Kevin, how would you?
Exactly. I would say somewhere where they're comfortable. Let's talk about location first. Not in a Starbucks, in a coffee shop, in a restaurant, because what you're going to be asking this person to do basically is to let go of their emotions and tell you really what's going on in their life. So if you want to have this conversation, a meaningful conversation, where they're comfortable, where it's very private, and, hey, I'm worried about you. This is what I've seen. Is there something going on? I want you to know that I'm here for you, and you have my phone number. You can call me 24 hours a day. You know, I'm here for you, and there's others here for you. And I tell folks, These folks that are suffering feel that they're alone, that they're stuffed in a corner all by themselves, but they're not. We need to normalize their situation. So many things are going on that so many other people have gone through those same things. So it's normal. They're not in a corner by themselves. There's a lot of help out there, but they need to come out and at least talk about it, talk about what's going on with them.
And my other question about how to help people is what about with somebody who is maybe on the verge of suicide, and you're concerned that someone, you know, may have plans for this weekend or tomorrow, how do you talk to that person then?
If I had those kind of concerns, we would need to go to a hospital or a mental health place. If I really believe that, hey, this is what I think, unless they can really persuade me out of it, I'd much rather be almost lose a friend for a while, because they're going to get mad at you and all that, but they're here. And then later on, when they get better, hopefully, they're going to be back, and they're going to love you so much more because of what you did. You saved them.
Jenna, does one call 911, or does one call crisis line, or does it not matter? Wherever they call, they're going to get put in the right place?
Ideally, they would call the crisis line first. One of the challenges is that law enforcement gets lots of phone calls where crisis should be engaging instead of law enforcement and really taps the system to be able to effectively do that. So ideally, they would call crisis services as the first phone call. And then if they needed to, obviously, they would call their local law enforcement and ideally ask for a CIT, a crisis intervention trained officer. All of the officers here in Portland are CIT trained, but across the state, we've trained officers out of every department in the state, varying numbers, but to ask for an officer who had some background in mental health and mental illness.
Kevin, how has training for officers changed in the years that you, 23 years, correct, with the
right.
California Highway Patrol? I have a feeling when you started there wasn't, this isn't something you learned at the academy.
Absolutely correct. I had no training, zero training. And to put someone in that position on that bridge with nothing, really, but the skills that I had grown up with and learned from other jobs, it was really, really tough. It was very scary because I'm thinking if this person jumps, I mean, I'm responsible for this person. You know, it's very, very tough. It took a long time before I actually received any kind of training. But eventually I did. Be honest with you, I think in the Highway Patrol, we're still lacking. We're still looking at it as something that's secondary where we need to in our own place, in the CHP. Between 2003 and 2007, we lost 13 officers to suicide. It's a wake-up call. There's a lot of stuff going on. People are hurting. We can go to these classes. We can learn about these things, the signs and the symptoms, and have that conversation. It just starts right there. But the training that I did receive, it was great. It really was. But it was years into it, which isn't right.
And I think he raised a really important point about the fact that law enforcement population has twice the suicide rate as the general population. Male officers have a 20% higher rate of depression. Female officers a 50% higher rate of depression. So we need to talk about mental health, both what law enforcement and others do to respond, but also keeping in mind that folks in high-stress jobs, especially public safety, are at greater risks. We're really excited that the Criminal Justice Academy here in the state of Maine is now offering mental health first aid to every cadet. So every new cadet that graduates has gone through an 8-hour national evidence-based course called Mental Health First Aid. So it's a step, and it's a step to really, and that's focused more on their mental health than the mental health of others. But really to have these conversations and address the stigma and make it, as Kevin said, something normal. We all have mental health and we need to be comfortable talking about it.
Sure. And, you know, you talked about high stress jobs, but also the trauma. The two times you've lost somebody, that is traumatic to you.
Oh, you're absolutely right. You know, and there's other cases where I was the primary officer, so to speak, where I've seen folks go. And it's horrible. I feel responsible. And I tell folks, I think a little piece of me died with them. It's going to be in my head forever. It's the way it is. It's trauma on your brain. You know, we're not rigged to see that type of stuff, but it happens. And now we need to work on this, how we can continue on. Now, fortunately, the majority of folks we speak to do come back over that rail if we get a chance to speak with them. But the ones that we lose, we take it to heart. It's tough.
How many of the people that you got to climb back over the rail and into the rest of their lives, how many of them tell you they wish they hadn't?
I haven't had that yet.
You haven't had that in the hundreds and hundreds. And I think that's a really important message for somebody who may be contemplating suicide, that everybody who doesn't do it is glad they didn't.
Right. On that time when they were there, they want to do it. They think there's no way out. There's no resource. There's no recourse for them. They've exhausted everything. But if we can get them past that time frame, some people just deliberate for 5 minutes before they will try suicide. If we can get them past that and then ask them in a few months and say, no, I'm so glad that I did come back. But at that certain time, I did. I was there ready to go. But they're so happy to come back.
One thing I thought was so interesting in doing some research for this program today, something I'd never heard before, was that with young people, there's often just one episode of contemplating suicide. And whether that's a week or 5 minutes, if we can help that young person get through that, it's not going to happen again. That's fascinating.
Absolutely. There are plenty of people, especially younger people, who don't quite have the emotional tools to process upsetting things, who contemplate suicide at that point in time and never again the rest of their lives. The importance is that they have someone they can talk to, that they're not judged for having those feelings, and that they feel safe to talk about them. and really that we create a culture that someone can share that kind of concern without the adults having shock and horror, or equally important, without having their peers keep that secret. You know, the secret around, you know, drinking and driving, kids don't do that anymore to the same extent, definitely, as before. But they're still keeping secrets around intentions of their friends to die by suicide. And we really need to change the culture and make it so that folks know if they need help and they say something, they're not going to be punished. Young kids are going to get help. And that's an important part of the message.
Kevin Briggs, you have a TED Talk, which we will post on our Maine Calling Facebook page, in which you say you explain how important it is that people who are considering suicide know that someone cares. And I don't want to take words out of your mouth, but if you can explain what you mean by that.
Absolutely. When I'm talking to someone over that rail, my sole focus is on them. I turn off my cell phone. I turn off my police radio. Everything that I do is a negotiation with them. And I do care. I absolutely care. This is a life I feel in my hands. And it's not, to me, it's not saving the life. It's not winning. It's helping that person on the darkest time. So when they do come back over, I could say, yeah, I was a conduit maybe with that. But I can only imagine what is going on in their head. They are so frightened and so scared. I think very narrow in their sight and their thinking that they feel they have to do this. There's no way out. So I try to provide different things to make them look a little bit more around and see, you know what? Maybe there is a glimmer of hope. I want to do this again. I want to come back.
We have to take a break. But when we come back, I want to ask you all some of the signs. I understand suicide ideation is very complicated, but something that our audience can come away with. And I also will get to our audience comments and questions. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Collins Center for the Arts with Bram Stoker's Dracula, presented by LA Theater Works October 10th, collinscenterforthearts.com, and Casella, committed to safe, efficient disposal of non-recyclable waste for all 16 Maine counties, Casella, giving resources new life.
The Great Depression left millions of able and willing Americans bewildered and jobless.
In the Depression of the 1930s, the federal government put some people back to work making art. I'm Erwin Gratz, Friday and Morning Edition, The Art of the Works Progress Administration. Also, the day's news and the weekend weather. That's Morning Edition, Friday, 6 to 9 a.m. here on MPBN.
Did you ever miss hearing the day's main news on MPBN Radio and wish you had? Perhaps you didn't hear Morning Edition or All Things and Maine Things Considered. Well, we've got you covered. This Day in Maine is a new podcast available online each evening by 7 o'clock that's about the day's Maine and only Maine news. It's hosted by MPBN's Barbara Caritti. This Day in Maine has all the day's Maine issues, news, and events coverage as reported by the MPBN news staff. Stream it on your computer or your device, get the podcast, and listen whenever and wherever you want. A great and convenient way to stay up on Maine news. This Day in Maine at mpbn.net.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, suicide prevention. With me in our studio, Jenna Menhert. She is executive director of the Maine chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Also with us, Kevin Briggs. He's a California highway patrolman who's known as the guardian of the Golden Gate Bridge. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We will get to audience questions in just a minute, but I want to talk about this idea of signs. What should a loved one or friend be looking out for? Are there red flags, or is it really not that simple?
There's always signs. It's just depending on whether you're the person who sees those red flags or not. So that's one of the things we talk about. We do gatekeeper trainings all over the state in partnership with the Maine CDC for free. If people are interested, they should come to NAMI's website that really help people to understand the signs and the symptoms for how they can identify this as a potential risk. But hopelessness is really the heart of it. A sense, as Kevin has said, a sense that being in this dark place. So whether someone's lost a job, lost a relationship, got in trouble with the law, or they're struggling with a mental illness and they've, you know, not seeking appropriate treatment, a sense of hopelessness is really the common theme. And really being the person who sees that someone's behavior's changed or that they're in this place and taking action, because folks don't show their true selves to everybody. So if you're the person who sees it, you shouldn't assume, well, everyone else sees this, so someone else will do something.
Oh, wow. I've heard stories about people having some equanimity before they actually make the attempt, where they have a period of hopelessness. And then when they make the decision, they're almost in a good mood and almost trick the people around them. And those people think, wow, he's figured it out. He's doing better. You're both nodding.
You're absolutely correct. I've seen it. I've heard it from people. I've heard it from parents of kids that tell me, wow, they were suffering. Grades were going down, absenteeism. And all of a sudden, boom, things were just going really well for a week or so. And then the kid's gone. You know, and we've seen this. We know about this from time and time again. People get it in their head. They make a plan and then say, all right, they have relief because they think it's going to be over. And now they're just going along with it.
Mm. We're going to go to, we just lost somebody who'd been waiting a while. But we'll go to Alex in Rochester, New Hampshire. Hi, Alex. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I take a special interest in the show today. Exactly 1 year ago, on October 8th, 2014, my long-term girlfriend died by suicide. And I still miss her terribly. She suffered from mental illness through no fault of her own. And I'm keenly aware of the stigma surrounding both mental illness and suicide, as I myself also have a mental illness, and I've been suicidal at times in my life as well. And she was a long-term resident of Maine and had been to various hospitals in Maine, various psychiatric hospitals in Westbrook, Waterville, including I think it's a state psychiatric hospital in Augusta. I think it's called Riverview, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say I myself, I have bipolar disorder, and several years ago, back in 1999, I was wandering around in the southwest area of the U.S. I was delusional, I was psychotic, I was completely sober, I wasn't doing any drugs or alcohol, I was just not on any kind of psychiatric medication, and I made my way to San Francisco, and I walked halfway across the Golden Gate Bridge, and I was worried about jumping. I thought, maybe this is my time to go, but I didn't. And to this day, I still think that there must have been people who were praying for me. Maybe there were some passing motorists who saw me walking out there, and I did not climb over the side of the railing there, but I thought about it, you know, and from that day onward, I made my way back to New Hampshire, where I currently reside. But my point is, there is a huge stigma around mental illness, and there's a stigma around suicide. And unfortunately, you know, there's this idea that everyone who commits suicide is doing so for selfish reasons, and that's just not the case. Like in my girlfriend's case, she was working closely with her doctor, her mental health care team, and she was taking her psychiatric medications as prescribed. But she had a recent change in her medications, which led to her being psychotic again and becoming suicidal through no fault of her own, and died by suicide, believing that people were coming after her. And it's been very hard for me to cope with the way that she physically passed. But I myself have taken, you know, one of the ways I've coped with that is I've tried to be a bit of an advocate by writing letters to my local paper, letters to the editor. And in fact, today I have a letter published in my local paper about the stigma of suicide, just trying to address it in a respectful way.
Alex, I'm so sorry for your loss. Jenna, I suspect, unfortunately, what you're hearing from Alex is the kind of story you hear a lot.
Absolutely, from family members who have lost someone or from people who are in their struggle. Any of us who live with depression understand that no matter how intentional our journey is, there are times when we struggle And the importance is talking about that, making it so that talking about that struggle is no different than talking about the struggle around our cholesterol levels or, you know, our football injuries. That the more we can have those conversations, not only is it that we're then able to seek help, but in the case of his girlfriend who was seeking help, we can get better help, more help, accessible help. This is a really rural state, and lots of parts of Maine, there isn't access to good quality mental health services without a long drive. So the importance of really pushing that we should have true parity between mental health and physical health and the ability of our providers to help us along those journeys is an important message.
Alex, thank you for calling. We have on the line with us Senator Susan Collins. Hi, Senator Collins.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm so glad to join you with us in this very important discussion.
Just about an hour ago, you spoke on the Senate floor in support of a bill you've sponsored to help those with mental illness. Senator Collins, what do you believe is lacking in the system? What is not available that needs to be?
There are so many gaps in the system. There is a lack of providers. There is a lack of true parity, as Jenna just said, between the way we treat people with physical illnesses versus mental illnesses. There are privacy rules that can frustrate family members that are trying to help their adult children with severe mental illness. There is a lack of care for very young children who mm-hmm. are showing signs of illness. And there are also problems in the Medicaid program that prohibit Medicaid dollars from being used for inpatient psychiatric care for patients between age 21 and 64. There's so many issues that we really need a complete overhaul.
Are you confident that the bill you're sponsoring can pass and become law? Is there the political will to fund this or other measures that would achieve the goals you seek?
I am optimistic that this bill will pass. It is bipartisan. It's been introduced in both the House and the Senate. And with each passing day, I think Americans become more and more aware, based on their personal experiences, the advocacy groups, and people being willing to talk about mental illness in their own families, not to mention these horrific mass shootings. All of that combines to give a real impetus for Congress to finally act.
Well, Senator Susan Collins, thank you so much for joining us today, especially on this busy day when you have spoken right on the Senate floor.
Thank you. And again, thank you for holding this very important discussion.
Jenna, we have an email from, this is an anonymous email. More than once, I've heard parents of teens who have died from suicide say, quote, "I didn't see it coming." Teens are often on such an emotional roller coaster that it can be difficult to see a real crisis for what it is. Are there signs to watch for specifically for teenagers?
Well, I think this is where the peer group is really important, because it's true, as the parent of a 16 and a half year old, you know, I can say that she can be really upset about something one minute and happy another. And I don't know that I would be the first person who would see if something was really a struggle for her as much as her friends would. And that's where we really keep trying to work more and more with high school students to understand when their friend says something, what they can do about it without undermining that friendship, because we really want to have youth empowered to feel that they can help prevent suicide.
Okay, we're going to head to Scott. Scott, are you calling from Wyndham?
Yes, hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I just want to reiterate what a lot of people have already said, one of your guests, and that is to emphasize the importance of actually getting discussions like this out in the open and having people talk freely about it. I, for one, am the husband of a woman who has attempted suicide 3 times, one most recently 3 years ago. Thankfully, she received the help she's needed, and she's doing very, very well, but she struggled with depression her whole life. And she understands the need to talk freely about it. And she now blogs about it, and she writes about her experiences so other people can hear about what she's gone through, so that it won't be such a mystifying thing. time was 40 or 50 years ago that people wouldn't talk about cancer because that was a no-no in social situations. Well, that's where we're at with depression. Depression needs to be talked about as freely and comfortably now as cancer is because it's an illness.
Okay. Thank you for calling in, for supporting what our guests are saying here today. We have an email, and it's a long email, so I won't read the whole email, but it really is talking about the word suicide. Doesn't like, this is somebody who is says, in many decades of practicing clinical psychology, I've noted that once the word suicide is used, professionals and others focus only on trying to prevent someone from taking their own life rather than trying to understand why a particular person would want their life to end. Goes on to say, how can a person be helped to live with themselves and with others should, in my personal opinion, always be the focus. The word suicide or phrase suicide prevention has the direct implication that we are the ones who act to prevent someone else from acting. Thoughts on the word suicide from either one of you?
You know what? It's there. It's going to be there. What folks, I have heard what some folks don't like is the word committed suicide. That's a very negative way. A lot of folks now are saying that that someone has lost their life to suicide. It's there. We need to confront this. We're not gonna, if we hold this back and not say this word, we're just sweeping it over. We need to confront this, say it, and in my belief, we need to start it in the schools, bring it up. If you bring up the word suicide, it's not going to plant that into somebody's head. If they had plans for it, they would have been thinking about it for quite some time.
And I would say the way that I agree with the clinician is that we do need to talk about mental wellness and promoting mental wellness very young. And we need to, you know, half the people will develop an anxiety disorder, do so by 11, mood disorder by 15. So we really need to equip people with the skills young to understand their particular challenge in life, be it a mental health challenge. But then when we're getting to the point of someone making the decision to die by suicide, that is a point in time situation we're looking at. And to echo what the caller said, I lost my grandfather. My mother was only 9 months old to suicide. He happened to have died off the Brooklyn Bridge. My mother, her entire life, said he died of a heart attack until finally when her own doctor said, wait a minute, your father died of a heart attack at 34? You know, and then she's like, oh, no, wait a minute. You know, as an adult, she still was saying that. So we need to get rid of the stigma to recognize that, yeah, we want to talk about mental wellness and we want to give people the skills to be mentally well, but we still need to prevent suicide.
On that note, we're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions, please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Lee Nissan in Auburn and Topsom, with Level 3 charging stations available for all electric vehicle owners. Learn more at leeauto.com. And University of New Hampshire, whose open online course on New Hampshire's presidential primary starts October 19th. unh.edu/nhprimary.
On the next Fresh Air, beautiful but often unsettling outdoor art, like a stone wall and a decaying tree trunk. We talk with sculptor Andy Goldsworthy. His materials include leaves, stone, twigs, ice, grass, and flowers. His ephemeral art melts, decays, or blows away over time, but that art is documented in a new book of photos. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And join us this afternoon following Maine Calling for Ideas from the CBC. Today's program, Enemies and Angels, the story of two men during the Iran-Iraq War, one a wounded Iraqi soldier, the other an Iranian medic who saved him, and the coincidence which would reunite them decades later. That's Ideas from the CBC coming up after Maine Calling at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how to help those considering suicide. In the studio with me, Jenna Menhert. She's executive director of the Maine chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Kevin Briggs is a California Highway Patrolman with assignments including patrolling the Golden Gate Bridge. Share your thoughts. Our number 1-800-399-3566. And Kevin, a retired California Highway Patrol officer. I apologize for that. We're going to go to Bucksport and David. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you. A very important show. I'm happy to be able to speak with you all. I've worked many years with lesbian and gay and transgendered bisexual youth, and I'd like to at least mention the fact that statistics still show that youth dealing with sexual orientation diversity are still stigmatized to the point where their mental health is at great risk. I think the statistics show that they attempt suicide at a rate 3 to 5 times higher than their peers. We can work on that culturally by helping everybody's mental health to learn to destigmatize sexual orientation diversity so that young people don't grow up fearing that they don't have a possibility of a joyful, fulfilled future if they happen to be lesbian, gay, transgender, or bisexual. So could we have some comments from the professionals there, please?
Jenna.
Absolutely. NAMI Maine actually has a federal Garrett Lee Smith grant focused on high-risk youth populations, specifically lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered youth, working across the states with school-based health centers to focus on preventing suicide in that high-risk population, and absolutely agreeing that there's such high levels of bullying related to sexual orientation that we need to confront that as well, and absolutely raise awareness and acceptance and help folks, young people, to have hope. Whatever barriers people put in front of them, we need to really work through. And absolutely, that population struggles because of people's homophobia.
An email from Thea. Suicidal thoughts are not always caused by mental health. Sometimes it is situational. I have a chronically ill child whose illness has no known cure. I spent most of my time researching how to help him. At the same time, I'm too ill. I have no emotional support and have blatantly told friends and family that I'm deeply depressed and overwhelmed. They are unresponsive. It is the hopelessness of the situation that is causing suicidal thoughts. Kevin, this is what you said in the beginning of the program.
Right. And you know, that unmanageable health care or health system, whatever you have going on with you, that's tough. You know, and we see that with older folks, too. If a spouse dies, that it just breaks their heart. But these unmanageable health conditions are very, very tough. I would just hope that beyond their family, they would get in and see a professional about this.
And I think it's true. I happen to have a child who has autism, and he looks at, you know, sort of his life outcomes and gets depressed about it, right? And the importance is having conversations, finding resources, realizing that depression actually often co-occurs with health challenges. So while it's true, there are people who attempt or die by suicide who have no history of a mental illness, and it's a point-in-time crisis. They've lost their job at the mill. Their girlfriend's dumped them. They may find themselves in a suicidal crisis, but there's a lot of mental illness depression that co-occurs with health challenges.
Okay, we're going to head to, let's see, Melissa, who's calling from Bridgewater. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just wanting to talk about the difficulty in accessing health services for people who are depressed. I've been depressed for much of my life, connected to eating disorders primarily, and I think genetic factors. But I applied for Maine Care in Maine and was turned down because I'm a single adult without children, and actually had to move to Massachusetts, where they have universal health care, in order to access services. I saw a counselor there. My counselor suggested I see an endocrinologist to have my vitamin levels checked, and now I'm on a hyperdose of vitamin D, which has been amazingly helpful. So I just wanted to say that we can talk about this, but there are real challenges for people in Maine who want to get care.
Yeah, and you know, we also have an email from Cynthia who in Lymington, who is talking about how hard it has been for her family to access inpatient services in Southern Maine. Jenna, you are nodding.
Well, just it's a fact. We're a state that didn't go for expansion, so there are still plenty of Mainers without insurance who are unable to access mental health care even when they want to. Or there's the barrier of where they live and where there's an appropriate provider for what they're looking to understand and the journey they're on. So unfortunately, we operate a helpline at NAMI Maine, and one of the most common calls, if not the most common call, is people trying to access help and not being able to access that professional level of care because they don't have insurance.
And this emailer, Cynthia, said in her case, even though they had insurance, there were just not enough beds available.
That's a huge challenge, too.
Wow. Thank you for calling, Melissa, and good luck to you. We are going to go to Bangor and Stephanie. Hi, Stephanie. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Good afternoon. I was very surprised to hear your show this afternoon. I had a very emotional morning with my son, who told me that yesterday, he's 17, that he was contemplating suicide. He had written a note, he had a plan, and then he couldn't follow through with it. Now, I'm a nurse, and clinically, I was thinking, okay, I need to do this and this, but the mother side of me was just screaming inside and trying not to cry and thinking, what can I do to help him? He refuses to see a counselor. He's in trouble in school. He's not in trouble anywhere else. And I guess I'm just kind of lost. The professional side of me has been pushed aside, and the mom in me doesn't know what to do.
Right. And you know what? What's happening to you is big with first responders, healthcare givers, is we give so much to everybody else that we fail to see what's going on with us sometimes and our families. But I can tell you that this is your son. He needs to get in to get some help. Now, to explain that to him, the desire comes from the love that you have for him. I need you to be around. I love you. I care for you. This is what we need. We need to make a plan together, and I'll be there the whole way along with this. So let's start working on this one step at a time.
Jenna, do you have thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's important that you get him to talk. And I think this is really hard as a parent to hear what they have to say without having a reaction, your heart break, or, you know, to be visibly shaken. And sometimes somebody else is the right person to start that journey, to get them to talk about going for help, and to think about whether you're that person or if there's another person in your son's life that they might be more willing to commit that they'll go talk to somebody with or to start that journey with. I think it's important to think about your child's need to and how you help them get help, and to try to focus on that, which is really hard at that point in time.
Stephanie, do you have more questions for our panel?
I'm just curious where to start. I've spoken with this guidance counselor, and I live in, Washington, Hancock County. Mm-hmm. We have very limited services here. If the guidance counselor can't provide me with anybody, I don't know where to go next.
Have you called the crisis line in the state of Maine's crisis line?
I did not.
Okay. Well, we're going to get that number to you, and then you can because the way that the crisis services work in the state of Maine is that they're divided up by county. So it's one centralized number, which, of course, I should have memorized. But and when you call them, it rings to your local agency. It doesn't mean that crisis is going to come storm your house, but they are probably either that, you know, you could call them and get an idea about what resources and where to start with this, how to get your child help, or whether it's a crisis worker that would come to your house and have a conversation with your son to help you in that conversation. Because I know that resources, you're not in a resource-dense part of the state, and so it is a challenge. And really, the Department of Health and Human Services funds the crisis line so that families have a number, or individuals have a number they can call to get connected to the crisis system, so they don't just show up at a hospital or have to call law enforcement, which in some cases is, you know, just not really the right response. In the case of your son, it sounds like you and your son need to come up with a plan, and you need some help to figure out that plan. And I'm happy, I guess I shouldn't say it over the radio, to give you my cell phone number and have NAMI Maine help you. It's what we do. But I also think you should contact the crisis agency. If you don't get what you need from them, then you need to call us at NAMI Maine. And I'm Jenna, and we'll get you connected to how we can be helpful.
And Stephanie, what we're going to do here on Maine Calling, we're going to put you on hold. So if you can stay on the line until the end of the program, we'll see if we can find that phone number for you. And if we get that phone number before the end of the program, of course, we will say it out loud on the air. So just please stay on the line with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to move on. We're going to go to Bill in Hamden. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, yes. Thank you very much for taking my call. We lost our youngest son. Daniel, to suicide in 2003. We have gotten involved with a group, and this is a topic for another show, obviously. But we have a support group. My wife and I facilitate a support group here in Bangor that meets once a month. And there are other groups around for people who have lost someone to suicide. But like I said, that's I'm sure could be another topic that we could talk about. Couple of comments that I wanted to make, and I think that your guests, Jenna and Kevin, have alluded to this. Talk does not cause suicide. That if, like your last caller, whose son had stated about suicide, getting help, and if you have someone and some of the signs, warning signs and red flags that come up, if you hear those, the need for seeking help or having the person talk. The other one of the things, and I believe Kevin was talking about this, that a lot of times people seem to be getting better, and part of that is that, as he said, that they've decided themselves that they're now ready. And especially with people who go through depression, I always talk about it being kind of an up and down. And a lot of times when the person is on the upside of that depression, they can see what the pit looks like, and they don't want to go there again. And you hear it on TV, some of the advertisements about depression being disabling. Well, when they're down low, they don't have the strength to do anything. But when they get up high, so I guess that's one of the warning signs. If someone is going through cycles like that, a friend or a family member, that's one of the signs to look at to get help.
Bill, thank you so much for your call, and I'm so sorry for the loss of your son. I invite you to go to the MPBN Main Calling Facebook page and put information about the support group that you have in Bangor. And if we have listeners in Bangor, perhaps they can go there and learn about your support group. Thank you so much for calling today. And I think we have time for one more call. We're going to go to Al in Stratford, New Hampshire. Hi, Al. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Thanks. I'll try and not ramble here. I think that it's easier to, there's an old saying, fix a child than repair an adult. I think I've suffered depression all my life. I'm 60. And I really think the set of guidance counselors in the grade schools, there should be a system for anonymous, for children to get together. And, you know, if they come from dysfunctional families or what have you, and learn coping, learn life skills as early on as possible to buffer some of the depressive times that you're going to have in life. And for those people that live with somebody that's depressed and suicidal, that's so hard for you. You can't talk about it because they push you away. I know. And one thing that's so difficult for families, but when you think that person that's depressed doesn't care, they care so much that they can look at it. If they can look at it, they'd scream. It's not easy for anybody around, and I don't know the solution. I'm slowly killing myself with cigarettes because I can't bring myself to suicide. But at least one question for you folks. Do you think, because I think this heroin epidemic, and I've looked at it, I think for some, they're using that as a way to get out. Because, we don't want to die. We just can't take the pain. Thanks. Sorry if I rambled.
Sure.
How about I hang up?
Sure, Al.
We know actually in the state of Maine there was a point in time study around heroin overdoses that 20% of heroin overdoses were actually determined to be suicide. And we also all know that there's plenty of substance use that is a form of self-medication.
Kevin, you're speaking tonight at the Portland Public Library at 5
yes.
p.m. It's open to the public. So if someone's heard you here today and wants to get to meet you in person or learn about your book, what are you going to talk about tonight?
I'm going to talk about a variety of factors, but one is having that courageous conversation. How can we work up to that? Who's going to do it? Maybe you see some things. Maybe a coach sees some things. The teacher sees some things. How do we put all this together? We need to work as a team. This is a team effort. It really is. So Jenna talked about this. Maybe it's not you that's going to have that conversation, but somebody needs to. And we need to start off, how do we do that? What don't we say? I'm going to talk about a number of things tonight. So please come on down.
Fantastic. That's 5 p.m. at the Portland Public Library. We have Jenna found the crisis lines. This is for you, Stephanie, and for anyone else who might be worried about a loved one. The statewide crisis hotline, 1-888-568-1112. Again, 888 866-568-1112. We will also post that on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page. And in Hancock and Washington County, the crisis hotline, 762-4851. If you are in Hancock or Washington County, 762-4851. Thank you both so much for being here today on Maine Calling. Jenna Menhert, the Executive Director of the Maine Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Kevin Briggs, a California Highway Patrol officer, a retired California Highway Patrol officer, with assignments including patrolling the Golden Gate Bridge. John Keimel ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, a link to our audio archives, and a way to sign up for our podcast by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at midnight. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.